If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, you better watch out.
Arr.
What was that? Was that a cough?
It was a cough.
All right, everybody. Welcome to... Totally, my timing's all the way gone now. Welcome, everybody, to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is another Wednesday evening. This one happens to be March 15th, 2017, at about a minute past 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So, for Universal Time, that would put it at 2:01, March the 16th, 2017. So that, of course, means we are live, and our chat room is where all of our crew members are, and we invite you to join the crew of Space Pirate Radio by coming over to astronomy.fm/chat. It's also on the homepage. Go there, hit the login button, and join our chat room. We talk about specific articles. We'll put links to the articles so you can do a little bit more further reading. If you have any questions for us, feel free to ask us and we will answer them, or other people in the chat room will be glad to answer the questions too. So let's say hi to everybody in our chat room. We've got, are you in there? Yes, you and me. We've got Sky Guy Nick, Twist Edge, Cork, Glenn, Aquafew, Plaid Joan, Plaid Sister, Evil Spock, and Plaid Mac. The Plaid crew is here too tonight. Welcome, everybody. We were a bit off last night. No, last week, I mean. Sorry.
Knocked offline by 60-mile-an-hour winds, more like.
With almost 70-mile-an-hour gusts. Yes.
Yeah.
Down all over. Almost a million people without power. And I think some people, last message I got from somebody a week later, they still did not have power.
There are people in the Metro Detroit area in Southeast Michigan who still don't have power, correct?
Yep. So, and the temperature, by the way, this morning was like 13 degrees above zero Fahrenheit. And still got some pretty cold winds out there. Yes, it's really, really cold and it's nasty and it's not a good time. And we haven't even hit the spring ice storm season yet.
No, it's been, we had a warm up and then we had the winds and then we had a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. So it has been a fairly punishing week.
Not just a warm-up, but we've actually had the warmest February on record.
That is correct.
2017. Oh, wait, it was second warmest February on record, sorry. Not the warmest, but second warmest.
Yeah.
I think last year was the warmest.
But, so obviously all the plants and animals and everything else were waking up from their winter slumber, which was rather short this year, and then boom.
I know, I've seen robins. I think robins eat worms, and like, how do they survive in this cold weather? I see them parked in trees and kind of fluffed up, and
that I encountered one of them at my doorstep today. Yes, fluffed up, almost spherical, looking very unhappy.
Yes, indeed. I did see a couple little warm spots where the sunlight. It was sunny today. It was nice and sunny and clear all day, so we had that benefit. I did see kind of one in a little bit of warm dirt in the corner of a building. So maybe they got something. Yeah, it's nasty. Can be bad for trees and everything like that too. We had our maple festival over the weekend, and usually they tap maple trees this time of year.
But, yeah, how'd that go?
No, the tree sap was running a month ago.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
we're past time now. So, what happens if you're not familiar with maple trees? The sap runs up and down in the trees in the springtime. At nighttime when it's cold, it doesn't run, but then in the daytime when it reaches 40 degrees, the sap will run up the tree. And then at nighttime, it gets cold and runs back down again. So what they do is they'll drill a hole in the side of a tree, and they'll actually collect that sap. That sap is a very small percentage, about a half a percentage of actual sugar. So they collect that sugar water in pans and boil it down till it gets like maple syrup. And that's how it's made. But you have to catch it at the right time, because after that point, we have those cold nights below zero, not below freezing, and then warm days above freezing. After you get that point, when it's too warm, the sap will run all the way up into the tree buds. There's kind of a biological reaction with enzymes, and the sap basically gets contaminated. And I've made some sap before, just some syrup before with that late sap, just to see what it was like, and it kind of smelled like rotting meat.
Really?
To give you an idea how bad, yeah, maple syrup can be if you catch it, make it at the wrong time. Yeah.
Well, I found out recently that maple syrup has the same, I think, active ingredient as the herb fenugreek, which is not terribly common in U.S., you know, middle America cooking. So, in fact, I couldn't even find anyone. I needed some, so I substituted maple syrup, and that worked all right. So it kind of makes sense that if maple syrup goes wrong, it goes wrong in a very weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's some powerful stuff.
Yes. So, no fun there. So you kind of wonder how the maple syrup industry is doing. Last I heard, they got not as much sap as usual. So we'll see what happens and see what happens year after year if we keep getting, you know, mixed weather seasons. Not going to be good for a lot of industries.
No, well, the maple syrup trees have been creeping north. I used to spend a fair amount of time in Canada, in northern Ontario, where it's maple syrup country there.
Uh-huh.
And, yes, the trees were on the march, fleeing the southern border of the climate zone and going northward.
You get problems with, like, in Michigan, we have a lot of cherry trees. So
yes.
you get early blooms, and then you get a good hard freeze after that, can kill the cherry blossoms.
Happened a couple of years ago, and we had to ship in the cherries from someplace else for the annual cherry festival.
Yes, indeed.
And we didn't have a lot of apples that year either.
Yep.
Yeah.
So this fluctuating weather like this is not good. Now, I remember people saying in February when it was hitting 55 degrees, like, global warming's not so bad.
Mm. No.
Then we get this.
No.
Super freeze. Yes.
Yeah.
It is a bad thing.
I was not celebrating the warm weather.
Me neither.
I knew this was going to happen, and boy, did we get hammered.
Well, I didn't know the cold was going to happen, but I'm thinking, well, if it's 55 in February, what's it going to be like in July? It might be too hot.
It worries me, too, because last summer was intolerable as far as I was concerned.
Australia's complaining about super hot.
Well, and super hot leads to wildfires because super hot also involves there's an increased risk of lightning,
mm-hmm.
which means there's going to be burned out areas of, you know, dry trees, dry grass. It's a horrible combination. These things just amplify.
Yes. So we'll see what the summer brings. It'll be what it is. Do the best we can. Look at the sun, blank. It's been blank for 9 days in a row, actually. No sunspots on the sun at all. Doesn't look like much solar activity. For those of you with hydrogen alpha telescopes, I think it's okay to get a look at the sun the next day or so, because it looks like there's a tiny little active region right on the edge of the sun right now, so that usually indicates some decent prominences. So look along the eastern edge of the sun and see if you see some prominence is just beginning to rotate on. NASA was reporting a coronal hole. I don't see it on any of the SOHO pictures, but maybe it's still around the far side. I think it's around the far side because it's supposed to spin around, and we're going to get a little bit more solar activity as far as particles from the sun coming in about 10 more days or so are expected. So right now the solar winds are kind of low, on the low average side. Wind speeds are only about 400 kilometers per second. Particle density kind of low at 4.66 protons per cubic centimeter. So nothing right now. There still can be some aurora, really high latitudes, but not too much, but a little bit. So a little bit of activity, but not showing us sunspots.
Though we've had periodically beautiful crystal clear skies.
Uh-huh.
Here in Michigan, which is not normal for winter, but this has not been a normal winter. Did you see last night Spica, Jupiter, and the Moon?
I didn't get to see that. I forgot about that.
They formed a beautiful triangle.
Uh-huh. Some nice stuff on there. So since we're going with Jupiter in that area too, I want to remind you to keep checking out the moons of Jupiter, and you can find out their positions, what's going to happen, not their position, but what's going to happen with the moons of Jupiter at projectpluto.com. And I was just starting to scroll down there because I know that there's a point at opposition when something very interesting could happen with its moons, and I looked and I checked and I found it on April the 7th. That must be opposition, because what's going to happen is one of the moons will actually pass its shadow. So what's going to happen is the third moon, Ganymede, first its shadow is going to start going across the planet Jupiter, and then 12 minutes later, the transit, so the moon starts going across. So first its shadow, then the moon. The moon will actually pass its own shadow, and the moon will leave, and then the shadow will leave. That's a pretty cool event to see. Unfortunately, we're not going to see it here in North America or South America. Looks like it's about the middle of Asia, maybe a bit of Europe. We'll be able to see that because it is at 18 to 20 hours universal time.
Ah.
That puts it at like 1 o'clock in the morning for me. So maybe Australia will be able to catch a piece of that too. That sounds right. So check it out at Project Pluto. Go down to April the 7th, and you can see moon number 3. There's 4 listings for it, and you'll actually can see it ahead of time where it's going to happen. It's kind of interesting the way that's actually going to pass its own shadow. Now, what will be interesting is what is the alignment? How far north or south will the shadow be compared to the moon? Sometimes you can actually get a moon superimposed on its own shadow, but I don't think that's going to happen because I think that the plane of the orbit of Jupiter's moons is tilted a little bit too much right now, so I don't think that's going to happen. So I think you're going to see the moon pass, if I'm not, I won't want to guess. The moon will pass either north or south of its shadow. So there will be a point there where you'll actually see the moon and its shadow due north and south of each other, too. That'll be on April the 7th. For those of you in the lucky part of the world to be able to see that, check that out. That's pretty cool. And what else we got for Jupiter? Moons of Jupiter from inthesky.org. The next north or south passing of Callisto, the fourth moon, will be around March the 21st. And it looks like it'll be like about 6 hours universal time, something like that. You'll be able to see Callisto. It's either going to be due north or due south of Jupiter itself instead of on either side of it.
Callisto's cool that way. It's far out enough that it does some interesting things compared with the inner three Galilean moons.
Mm-hmm. Happens several times a month, actually. Just have to know when to look for it. And this is the best chart I found for it at inthesky.org. And then look at under charts, and then it's listed as the moons of Jupiter. You'll see those curvy lines going in front of that gray line. The gray line is Jupiter. The curvy lines are its moons. And the blue one is the fourth moon. Whenever you see that one in front of or behind the gray line, that means, it's going to be due north or due south of Jupiter itself. A lot of good time for Jupiter observing right now. Because it rises, when does it rise? About 11 o'clock in the evening?
I tend to go out and take a walk right before midnight, weather permitting, and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now we're cheating a little bit because the U.S. adopted daylight savings time, so we are on a messed up time zone relative to real time. We're an hour ahead.
Yep. So my local time, I'm showing Jupiter rising here in the Northern Hemisphere at about 10 o'clock in the evening. So at normal time, it would be about 9 o'clock in the evening.
Right.
See a lot of uproar about not doing daylight savings time.
Ban it. Kill it.
I'm starting to agree with that.
Like, make it go away.
Yeah, I did enjoy in the summertime when it'd be getting close to 10 o'clock in the evening and I'd still be outside doing stuff in the yard and stuff like that. But you know what? You get used to a normal pattern, it slowly changes. It's a lot easier than that abrupt change of when you have to go to work. daylight and stuff. It's not that much difference 1 hour.
It is, though, because I noticed it. It was Monday afternoon, and I was sitting on the couch attempting to get my internet to work because after the windstorm, it still wasn't back to normal. And I was looking at the sunlight coming in through the window because it was a beautiful post-storm clear sky. I said to myself, oh, it's about 7 o'clock. Because when you are an amateur astronomer, as with some other hobbies, you do tend to get kind of in tune with the sun, basically, and the natural passage of time. I'm much more aware of the passage of time now than I was before I got seriously into astronomy as an adult. So I go, oh, it's about 7 o'clock. Looked at my wrist. Nope, it's 8.
Yes.
Congress says it's 8 o'clock, and therefore I have X number of hours to do my errands before I have to go to bed. And that was a bit depressing. And then the next morning, boy, oh boy, did I have a heck of a time waking up. Because, you know, I'm going up at 6:30. My body knows it's 5:30. My body was not happy with me.
Exactly.
And I repeat, 300 million people.
Mm-hmm. Slow changes are easier to adjust to than an abrupt one. So I would have no problem getting rid of daylight savings time. So what if it gets dark at 9 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock in the evening? That's okay.
Well, it's okay. So we're a bit biased because being amateur astronomers in Michigan, which is fairly north for the U.S., we realize that just south of 45 degrees is not particularly far north to many of you listening in from Europe. But for the U.S., Detroit used to be the northernmost city with a million people. Right. That means our astronomical window during the warm, stable, good-seeing summer months is lousy. You got like 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the further north you go, the worse it is.
Yep. Oh, well, I would have no problem getting rid of daylight savings time.
Yeah, I'd kill it. A bad idea. Bad idea whose time has passed.
Yes, I think so, too. Now, the storm, everything, I swear, happened bad all at the same time. The skies were getting, this is Wednesday, the skies were getting, going to be clear that night. We're having a little trouble with our scope at work, just some minor stuff, but we're going to have one of the techs that help put it together. He was going to come out, make some adjustments. We're going to go through some stuff, you know, shoot some pictures and things like that. So the guy was on his way, and I was getting ready, and had somebody else coming out, too, that was going to, from the astronomy club, that was going to help me shoot some pictures and stuff like that. And the storm hits and kills the power. So got a hold of him, the guy from the telescope place coming out. He was about halfway here and told him, nope, turn around, got power out. That was, now this high winds usually means blasting thunderstorms, right? When the big system rolls through. No, this was completely blue skies. Really, really clear. But 60, 70 mile an hour winds. Okay, and no power. No good. All right, so for the next 3 days, what did we have? Clear skies and no power. And then after that, what did we run to? We have clear skies and 10 degree nights.
Yep.
It's too cold for me to go out there and do that kind of stuff anymore.
Yeah, I'd heard, because I met up with some people from a fellow astronomy club that I don't really have close ties with more than a few people from. They're based out of Eastern Michigan University. Mm-hmm. So I got to tour their observatory, which is really cool. It was founded in the 1870s, and they had an old Alvin Clark refractor from the 4-inch refractor that was taken on a famous solar eclipse expedition to Wyoming that Thomas Edison looked through before he got famous. So it was a cool observatory, and it's up on, it's 5 stories high, and they've got rooftop viewing. And anyway, I was poking around having a great time. And they mentioned how the skies had been obviously darker Thursday and Friday night with all the power out. And I thought, it didn't even occur to me.
Uh-huh.
I was so busy with everything else, and my own power was erratic on Wednesday during the storm, but it came back, so I was fine. Didn't even think of it. It's like, here I am, amateur astronomer, blackout conditions, nearly a million people out of power in a heavily light-polluted area, and it didn't occur to me to go and get my telescope. I wanted to kick myself.
Uh-huh. Well, if you had anything, you know, longer than a Schmidt-Cassegrain grain, you weren't going to have too much luck using your telescope outside anyways that night. Well, the winds did die down quite a bit Wednesday. During the daytime,
High winds plus telescopes is a bad combination.
Yes, indeed.
Unquestionably. Binoculars, though. I could have gone out with binoculars.
Yep. Oh, well. Just a few observing sessions to me, too, and said the weather's just so cold now. That's not going to happen. So, got to wait for the weather to warm up a little bit. Of course, we're going to get a little bit more daylight, a little less nighttime observing. Things just don't come together sometimes, you know?
Mm.
Oh, well. That's the way it goes. All right, a little rundown on the moon and planets. Let's see. Conjunction with the sun. No, not even going to mention that one. The moon's at apogee on Saturday. Yeah, well, whatever. On Monday, Saturn will be 3 degrees south of the moon. March the 20th, Monday, is the equinox. We'll talk about that next Wednesday. We don't have time to talk about that, do we? We need to talk about the equinox tonight.
Yes.
We'll do that. Next Monday will also be last quarter moon. So we'll get into the equinox a little bit later, talk about what that's at. Let's see. One last thing. I wanted to go over this one, too. Next Saturday, I know we'll have a show before then, though, but Venus will be at inferior conjunction 10 days from now. So if you have not had your chances to go look at Venus in the evening sky, you better really hurry up because you've got 10 days to still have it in the evening sky or less.
It's still beautiful. It's beautiful. It's obviously not a round thing, even to the naked eye. You can see there's something a bit wobbly about this scintillating point of light. But Marty, since you're usually very conscientious about this, more so than I am, for the benefit of our audience, what is inferior conjunction?
Inferior conjunction means when in its orbit, Venus will go between the Earth and the Sun, but not necessarily passing in front of the Sun. And that's true of this time around, too. Technically, inferior conjunction is that when they both have the same declination. That's the north-south coordinate line. Technically, that is inferior conjunction. So when they are on the same coordinate line, north-south coordinate line, Venus will be approximately 7 degrees north of the Sun. Now, I hesitate to talk about this, but I'm going to try this. I've never done this yet. I've watched Venus a lot in the daytime. And a 7-degree split between the Sun and Venus, it is possible to see Venus right at inferior conjunction.
Ooh. If you dangerously.
Yes, indeed. Extremely carefully. So what you have to do is you have to shield the Sun, preferably like a building. So if you're out on the north side of a building in its shadow, so that the Sun is just below the building and you can still see above the building about 7 degrees, you can point your telescope and see Venus at inferior conjunction that way. Otherwise, you have to basically redo your telescope so that sunlight will not shine down your telescope and hit your main mirror, so that you can, if you have it like blocked off just right, I won't go into the details because if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't do it. So if you have the sunlight so it does not hit the mirror, that you can still point your telescope at Venus and be able to see Venus right at conjunction.
You are Solar Marty, the guy who shows the public solar observing. As a matter of course, I would put this more in the don't try this at home kids category.
Definitely don't try this at home. Yes, really, really risky to you
and your
telescope. Yes, indeed. So, for instance, like a refractor, this is not good for a refractor because it has the lens right out in the front. So there's nothing you could put on your telescope unless you put like a, you know, like a 4-foot long extension tube on the end of your refractor. Then it is possible to use that extension tube to block the sunlight from hitting the lens and still be able to hit the Venus light hit your lens. But it's really tricky. So basically, if the lens is right on the out the front there, there's nothing you could do to keep the sunlight from hitting your lens. Now, if the sunlight's hitting your lens but not going out the hole in the bottom, it could still be aimed at the side of your telescope.
Yeah.
And melt the inside of your telescope.
Yep, that has happened to people.
Yes. So if you point your telescope near the sun, you can melt your telescope. Now, some of the solar telescopes, the hydrogen alpha telescopes, they actually warn about this. Don't, for instance, if you're not tracking the sun, you don't have a motor drive, I should say, and you point your telescope at the sun with a hydrogen alpha telescope, you can look at the sun and see the prominences and flares and stuff like that. But if you leave it, the sun will drift off and the lens will focus light to the side of the tube and damage your solar telescope. There's warnings on that on the telescope itself. So yes, you can ruin your $700, you know, small sized beginning hydrogen alpha telescope that way.
And if you're using a cheap telescope, particularly anything with plastic optics, melted plastic. Sorry,
That would be the eyepieces. Yes.
Yes.
But that well, there's or like there's, solar projection.
Right. There's some things like the Galileo scopes. You know, the all plastic scopes that we handed out for outreach some years back. Yeah, those. No.
Yeah, you gotta be careful not to let those just set pointing towards the sun. Even if nobody's looking at it, you could easily melt a hole in the side of your telescope. It's not that hard to do. So don't do that. It would be better if you know somebody that has done this before, this type of observing, to maybe look through their telescope after they've safely looked through it and set it up themselves. But the best way is north side of a building with the sun, like at noontime, and the sun being blocked by the building itself, so you can see just above the sun. But it's risky.
Mm. I might try that sometime with you standing right there so I can punch you if I blind myself.
There you go. I'm going to do that this time if, of course, the weather cooperates, because we've had, you know, several days of really nice, clear, sunny skies. Like today, that means in 10 more days it'll probably be snowing again. So that's the way that goes.
Oh, it can totally snow in April, that's for sure.
I have not gotten a picture of Venus at conjunction. Would be really nice to see. But interesting, you could actually get sunlight going all the way around the planet Venus. So instead of like a really thin crescent that it is right now, which is still not too hard to look at right now, which is a really, really thin crescent, you can actually have sunlight going all the way around Venus. So it would be kind of neat. Like a ring around the planet. Yeah. That's because the atmosphere of Venus bends that light around the planet. So even though we would be looking at the total nighttime side of Venus, the air would bend the light around, make a ring around it. That would be pretty cool. But we'll see. I've missed that lots of times from conditions or weather or just not being at the right place at the right time or having the separation too close that you don't get it, you know, the planet far enough away so it makes it possible. I will see. I have to find the right kind of building. Maybe it works somewhere. I'll see what I can do. All right, I'll let you know. I'll take pictures.
Please. Share them.
I use a work camera. I don't want to break mine.
Oh, that's a nice option to have.
Actually, what I really like to do is use a video camera. Seems one of the best ways I like doing is point your something that's really bright, like Venus, point your scope at the planet and just point a video camera into the eyepiece. Works really good that way. All right, so I'll see what I could do. So it'll be Venus at conjunction at noontime, or close enough.
Close enough.
Yeah. We'll see what I get. All things work out together. 25th of March, by the way, is when that's supposed to happen.
The what of March?
25th. March 25 is inferior conjunction. Oh, and after that, by the way, Venus will be back into the morning sky.
Yep. Back is the morning star, the bringer of light, Lucifer.
Well, let's see. We're hitting the halfway point here, so it's time for us to do our station identification.
Indeed.
Listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is another Wednesday evening, and this one happens to be March the 15th, 2017. 9:30 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, Universal Time. That would be 2:30 on Thursday morning, March the 16th, 2017. So we still have half our program to go. And I want to remind you, don't forget to join us in our chat room where you become actually part of our Space Pirate crew. And so far we have a boatload of people in our crew tonight. We've got you and me. We've got Twist Edge, Sky Guide, Nick, Cork, Glenn, Aquafew, Plaid Joan, Plaid Sister, Evil Spock, Plaid Mac, Cassie, Mike, and Oz in our chat room. I invite you to join it. Come on over. It's really easy to get here. Go to astronomy.fm. You'll see where it says radio chat. Click on that or type astronomy.fm/chat. Either way, it will get you to the login page. Type in a name and hit login, and you'll be here in our chat room. It's real easy. Coming up after Space Pirate Radio, we have an extra treat for you tonight. We have, remember those times when we were missing Astronomy Ireland for like about a month or so because they just weren't producing shows then? Well, we happen to have two Astronomy Irelands tonight. So first up, coming up, Astronomy Ireland and Planetary Radio. After that, Comet Watch. And then last week's Astronomy Ireland and Planetary Radio, because our radio director said that last week's shows were really good from them. So we're having them tonight because we were off air last week. So
yeah.
Stick around, listen in. Don't forget we repeat these programs every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So you have plenty of time to catch up on those shows. Or stick around after Space Pirate Radio here and listen to Astronomy Ireland and Planetary Radio and Comet Watch twice.
Cool.
If you've noticed our... I put it on my personal Facebook page, but I also put it on our Space Pirate Radio Facebook page. Me holding a meteorite. Did you see that? It's a big meteorite, yes, from where I work. We've had this on loan for 3 or 4 months now, something like that, and it's going back to its original owner. This slab, it was actually a slice of a meteorite. I think it's about 12 by 18 inches, something like that, and about 3/4 of an inch thick. It's a meteorite from, where is that from? Semchen, Russia. That is spelled S-E-Y-M-C-H-A-N. They're not sure when this thing fell, but it was discovered in 1967. I think there was only two pieces. One was about 600 pounds, and the other one was about 100 pounds. Now, more recently, in 2004, they went back and found some more pieces. Now, the more pieces were actually a little bit different. The ones found in 1967 were classic meteorite. When you slice, and they're metal, by the way. They're iron and nickel. When you slice them and then you acid etch the surface, it gives this really nice iron mixed crossed crystal pattern to it.
Yeah, it's called a Widmann-Staaten pattern, and it's it cannot be faked. You cannot do this in a lab.
Right.
It takes millions of years of metal annealing to create that pattern.
But the new ones have a crystal in it called olivine, and that really surprised them.
Yeah, olivine, gem quality olivine is known as peridot. It's the birthstone for August. It's that green color. So you've got greenish or greenish brown crystals in a metal matrix, which is very pretty.
Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, in order to have olivine crystals, I think you have to have water. They dissolve, like water with olivine in it goes through the metal and makes a little crystals in the pockets, if I'm not mistaken. So the questions have been on this is, how does this stuff form out in space? Well, the metal's kind of basic. You know, basically it smashes together and heats up, and the metal goes down towards the center. But the other stuff would be, with olivine, it's considered more of a crustal material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crystalline. And
yeah. So how do you get crystal in something that should be down in the middle of it? So they're starting to think, change their thoughts on how different the situations may have been out in space. There may be more collisions. Maybe we had some like core type of asteroids colliding with mantle type of asteroids and kind of mixed the stuff together. I don't think they'd known about those types before.
Yeah, olivine is very interesting even on Earth because it's found in the mantle. So you often see it on the surface in volcanic areas. For instance, in Hawaii, there's actually a couple of beaches that yes. are made of green olivine sand, which I've seen one of these beaches, gotten to hold the crystals in my hand, and it's just stunning because it's this vivid, pale, slightly yellowish green of, hey, my birthstone. And yes, you mentioned water. Olivine might contain, trapped within it, dissolved in it, more water here on Earth than is actually in the oceans.
Ugh.
Yeah. And the spectral signature of it has been seen in dust disks around young stars.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a fascinating material. And it also makes for really pretty meteorite slices.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to see that, check out our Space Pirate Radio Facebook page. I just put it on there today. I'm holding it. It's 85 pounds, by the way, for that slab.
Aye, aye, aye.
Now, I tried to guesstimate how big the round portion was, and I kind of overguessed. I was guessing maybe 1,200 pounds, something like that. But turns out it wasn't that much bigger. It was only about 600 pounds. So this must be a very center section that I'm holding, and it got smaller on the edges after that.
Oh God, yeah, that looks like quite a hunk, Marty. I realize it must be fairly thin, but you're holding it with aplomb there.
Yeah, this is about it was 85 pounds. I think it's about 3/4 inch thick, something like that.
Nice.
The slice. And I looked online, I think it was Wikipedia or no, some other meteorite site. I can't remember, somewhere from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Shows a little bit more information about it and some of the other slices and then some chunks. And I think the one piece was found in a dry riverbed. So basically just laying out there. Another one was found with a one of those mine, like World War II mine detectors. Basically a metal detector, but they used it for, looking for landmines and stuff like this. They found the other one. It was about 100 pounds. And then, say, more recently, just about 10-ish years ago, they went back in the same area and were finding more of them, probably using metal detectors, but I didn't read any further than that. And they were finding them with the olivine in it. And they are for sale.
How much?
The big one's pretty expensive. There was some that was about a quarter of the size that I was holding for about 10-12 grand. But they had slices of the olivine ones, and you get those fairly cheap. About, I don't know, centimeter by two was only like $25-$50, something like that, for some small slices.
Oh, that's cool.
The more modern ones. So maybe I should get one of those from next time I see if our meteorite guy has one. The local meteorite guy comes to one of our public outreaches and see if he has any of those. Or maybe I just get some online too.
No, yeah, he's set me up with some good palisades. In fact, I was admiring once a large piece that he had. It was about dinner plate size, and I thought it looked gorgeous. It was just a matrix with big crystals.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, don't get that. I said, why not? He said, there's so much water in it that it's rusting. It's disintegrating. So eventually you will have a pile of rust with olivine crystals embedded. It's like, okay. Thank you for being honest.
How long is that going to take?
It was enough that the sample had degraded in the time that he'd been trying to sell it.
Oh, really?
So it was bad.
Oh, even in a few years then, huh?
Yeah.
Well, that would be kind of interesting. Anyways, buy that and do time-lapse photography of it.
Hey, man, if I'm feeling lucky next time he comes to town, yeah.
So I wonder if you could freeze-dry it, maybe something like that, suck some of the water out of it, or have that done regularly. And suck the water out of it and have the olivine crystals there
maybe
in the metal.
Store it in a vacuum. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That might at least prevent it from rusting. I don't know. It was... Maybe I'll talk about it with him. But yeah, I ended up buying a sample that was much smaller, but very pretty and in better condition.
What did you want for the big piece?
I don't remember.
Was it doable or still kind of outrageous?
I thought it was doable.
Oh, okay. We'll leave it at that. Everybody has their own doable price range.
Yes.
Well, anyways, this slab is not in the museum anymore. It went back to its owner. It was on loan to us for several months.
Was that one of the ones on loan from the Vatican, or who had?
No, it's just a private collector.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're hoping he would be able to consider leaving it in the museum for a longer period of time, forever. But nope, he wanted it back. Got other projects for it. So. Let's see. I've got a question in the chat room. Are all meteorites magnetic? And that is no.
Nope.
Because there are two basic, we'll just go real basic types of meteorites. One is mostly all rock, and the other one is all iron. So, and that the iron ones might not necessarily be magnetic themselves, but a magnet will stick to them because magnets stick to iron.
Iron nickel. And nickel is, of course, one of the magnetic metals as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're two different types. So, definitely the rocky types of meteorites, which are actually the most common, not magnetic, but they're also the hardest ones to find because of that. So if you have like lots of chunks of iron lying all over and you use a metal detector, you can find it. You have a good chance of finding a metal meteorite. But anywhere in Canada, northern Michigan, where the glaciers have rolled through and they've rolled rocks over and over and around, we have piles of rocks called moraines. Now, trying to find a space rock in a pile of rocks is about impossible. And then put dirt on top of it and trees and plants. And yeah, trying to find a rock in the middle of the woods is difficult. And then trying to find a space rock in the middle of the woods is even more difficult. So the rocky ones are almost impossible to find. The best way they find rocky ones, a couple ways, on ice, especially if the ice has been there for quite a while, like Antarctica, or if there's a recent fall, something that, a big one that was actually seen breaking up over a country, and they're able to, by triangulate where it broke up at, go in that area. And if the terrain is really good, go and look for the recent falls. Now, if it's, kind of civilized area, you can actually find them on a road right after a fall. Another good place for finding them would be like out in desert sand areas where it's basically all bunch of nothing but sand. So any rock that's out there in the middle of the sand has a better chance of being a meteorite also.
Yeah, when I was out in Holbrook, Arizona last year with some friends from the Astronomy Club, and we were looking for meteorites. Now, we had information that was not correct. So we were searching for rocky meteorites in basically gullies, little washes. So you're out in this field that's got these tufts of vegetation and a very sandy soil. And then in between the tufts of vegetation, there's little low areas and some dry stream beds and whatnot. So it was tricky. And I did actually find two things, one of which I think is a little tiny pinhead says meteorite with the nice, shiny crust on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, actually, we should have been looking in the tufts of vegetation with metal detectors.
Ah.
Next time. It was a fun day, though.
Glenn's asking, can you use a metal detector to find rocky ones? And that would be, nope, the rocky ones are not.
They're rock.
Yes, they have no metal in them, so you can't use a metal detector. You can't use a magnet to find them. So, no luck. I was at a kind of an off show one time, and this guy had what he thought were some meteorites, and he said he knew this area. I can't remember, was it Australia maybe, where they're all over the place. You could just pick them up off the ground. I can't remember if he was using a magnet or what, but they're just like all over these little gray, dark gray black things. And I thought, well, all right, I'm going to buy a little one. It was only like $10, about the size of a small marble, something like that. And I went and checked it out, and I don't know if I looked in the exact area, the approximate area, and I found out that area of the country is rich in hematite. Which is a type of iron. So, yes, he was finding rock, balls of iron all over the place that were natural from the earth, not meteorites. So I let him know. I checked it out at work with our geologist, and he looked at it, and I think I even, put it on a sander and I ground away one edge, one side of it, and it did not have that, crystal pattern. It was just smooth gray, and determined that, that was hematite. I contacted the guy, let him know, nope, this is hematite. And I even looked at online, and there were some papers on that area of the country where it is noted for hematites being all over the ground. You just walk over there and pick them up. So I told him, he offered my money back. I said, no, it's okay. I paid $10, and now it's a good sample of what's not a meteorite. I've lost it. I wonder if I can find that guy again and buy another one. But, yeah, I did a little bit of research to find out it was not a meteorite. I think he was kind of a rock collector, seller type of guy. And he said he contacted some other, experts, and they thought it was meteorites, but I double checked two validations. An old paper from the 20s said it was that area was all full of hematite, and plus just examining it properly said it was hematite. So hopefully you buy the real stuff. There is a bit of risk in buying meteorites. It's really good to know your dealer. The best way to know your dealer is know where he lives. So you can always come back to them and say, hey, this is not what you said it was. And if they know you, then fess up to it or just correct their mistakes. But if it's some guy that, you buy it online from just somebody selling one, it might not be real after all, even though it looks like a meteorite. We get a lot of meteorite mistakes in the museum. People bring something in and find out it's not. Usually it's slag. Something from metal processing, leftover material. It looks all bubbly, and that's not a meteorite. Let's see. All right, let's see if we get some other articles here.
Well, I've got one that I want to share because I'm a plain geek.
Okay.
So it's not news exactly, but it's a contemporary piece. And it is about a Boeing 747 that belongs to NASA. So NASA's owned a couple of notable Boeing 747s. One of them carried the space shuttles around and is now at home in Texas as a museum piece where I hope to visit it someday.
It was an Enterprise shuttle.
Yes, it was. This Boeing 747 has been modified to be a giant mobile telescope. So it's a 747 with a hole in the side, with an 8.2-foot telescope, and it's called the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, a.k.a. SOFIA. So it's used to study the atmosphere of other planets from a plane. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a United and a Pan Am passenger jet. So anyway, Wired has a cute little article on it. So I love planes. I love astronomy. I figured
that works for you. All right. So you got an article here on the health risks of traveling to Mars. And this is from a medical magazine. I think it's a leukemia magazine, actually. And they're pointing out, let me put the article in our chat room. I think John had it, Twist Edge had it in earlier. I'll put it in again, though. About the risk of radiation and what it does to your blood, for instance, and it actually kind of prevents your blood from reproducing. So that's not a good thing. So same conditions as leukemia. So they're talking about different ways of trying to prevent that, obviously. But yeah, that is one of the main hindrances of going to Mars, getting zapped by cosmic rays and particles from the sun and stuff like that, and having it disrupt your blood cells. Yeah, if it disrupts your blood cells so they can't reproduce, then you generally get less and less functioning blood cells, and that's not a good thing. There's a whole article on there. So talking about what they did was they did some simulations by putting, stem cells into some mice and exposing them to radiation and stuff like that. It was human stem cells, I think. But they're talking about they might be able to cure that with some dietary supplements. They're working on that.
Mm.
Instead of just shielding. So maybe something that would actually prevent the blood cells from being disrupted. That'd be interesting. So you could get zapped, but have it not affect you. Definitely got to do that stuff before heading out to Mars, though.
Yeah, actually, we saw one of the talks that I saw at the astronomy event at EMU on Friday was by one of her colleagues, and it was about colonizing Mars. And it went over the risk, not just the acute risk of getting zapped by an outburst of solar radiation while you're in transit, but just the long-term accumulation, both in the six-month, eight-month journey to Mars, but the kind of risk that colonists on Mars or the Moon or anywhere else are going to face on the surface
mm-hmm.
of a planet that doesn't have an active magnetic field or a body that doesn't have an active magnetic field.
We're talking about 3 months trips, three-year trips. You know, a year out there, a year on Mars, and a year back type of thing. So,
well, yeah, but even assuming somebody goes there on a one-way trip, with our current technology, at best, you're getting there in about 6 months.
Yes. You'd be surprised how much radiation you get just by flying in an airplane at high altitudes. You get like a chest x-ray for every time you go flying. So, rough
I'm
on pilots.
I'm flying on Friday. Don't tell me this.
Rough on pilots. So, you get another
That's
chest
true. X-ray. That's true.
So they're probably back to polar flights now. Flying over the North Pole can actually be a shorter trip than flying around the Earth. So when the sun activity is low, they will go back to flying over the North Pole, North Polar region anyways, to make a shorter trip to get to Europe and Asia that way. And once you go over the northern polar region, though, you're closer to the magnetic pole, and that pulls down energized particles coming from the sun and from space for our magnetic field. So you tend to get zapped more. But when there's less solar activity, the dosage goes down, so they can make those flights. But when we have a lot of solar activity, a lot of particles coming from the sun, they don't do those polar flights. They reduce them. So, but 9 days of no sunspots, I'm sure they're back to polar flights once again. Got an article here. U.S. and Russia may explore Venus together. Let me pop that into our chat room. Didn't get a chance to read that. But a joint venture sounds kind of interesting. I just imagine the conversation. No, please, you first go out the door. Oh, no. You go out the door first. I insist. Everybody's going to be really polite on that one.
Well, the USSR was an early Venusian or Cytherian, if you want to call it, pioneer.
Yes, they were.
They're not Cytherian, that's the moon.
They sent 16 space probes to Venus.
Yes.
Between 61 and 83. That was a lot. They were the ones that got those really great photos of the surface of Venus before anybody did.
Yeah, no, they had very ambitious plans for missions to Venus, very ambitious plans for Mars.
Mm-hmm.
The N1 rocket, the failed moon launch rocket that blew up all four times that it was attempted. Mm-hmm. It was originally considered as an interplanetary rocket for which it would have been much better suited because you wouldn't have a lander and you wouldn't have, you know, to worry about a return mission and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, That would be fitting if we could do a joint NASA Russian mission to Venus.
Mm-hmm. Read the article. Say I just saw the title and didn't get a chance to read it, so I'm going to save it for later. Check on that and see what kind of collaborative effort they plan.
Yeah. Well, it pointed out that the NASA really hasn't had a dedicated mission to Venus since the 1990s. Yes, Magellan.
Which was for not landing a pretty spectacular mission.
Yes.
And they had side imaging radar and were able to, with a decent resolution, image almost the entire surface of Venus through the clouds using radar, discovering craters and valleys and mountains and all kinds of stuff on Venus. And that gave us a really good view of what the surface of Venus really looks like. At reasonable resolution, but not really, really small resolution. And what was the lander that we had, too? Do you remember what that was?
I don't remember the U.S. lander.
I thought we had one lander. What was that? I don't recall. Oh, well. Nasty planet that you're, if you want to see it, you better get looking quick. Otherwise, it's going to slip into the morning sky, and you have to get up early to be able to see that. Be the morning star after a little while, too. So, last day of the evening star for Venus. And last of the UFO reports in the evening, too, I assume.
So. Yeah, it really is eye-catching. I could see how people might make that error.
Mm-hmm. Because it just sits there, and it sets very slowly. Mars is still out there, by the way. Mars and Venus separating. Mars slowly getting further and further towards the west, but it's taking a long time. It really takes like a good year or more from closest approach until it actually disappears out of the evening sky and gets back into the morning skies again. So Mars is still out there in the south from our northern hemisphere towards the southwest in the early part of the evening, so still visible. If you look at it with a telescope, it's really small. Hard to pick out any detail on it, but it's still out there. Uranus technically is between Venus and Mars. That one's pretty tough to see. No other planets until you get to Jupiter later on in the evening. But there is still the asteroid Vesta in the constellation of Gemini the Twins. Haven't had to check that one out yet, but it's actually pretty close to Castor and Pollux. So go look at asteroid number two or number four. Isn't it second biggest, but only number fourth discovered or something
like that? Yes, it is the fourth.
Yeah, pretty easy to see that one. And we're also starting to lose the Orion area of constellations in our sky. So
the last
of those.
As great hexagon of the northern winter and the southern summer is descending rapidly.
Yeah, so as in the northern hemisphere, we're starting to lose our nighttime, and we're starting to lose the Orion area. So combined together, we lose that pretty quickly. But we're getting into the galaxy region of Leo, Ursa Major, and Virgo. Time to start galaxy hunting once again.
Yep, spring is galaxy season.
Yes, indeed. Let's see. And there's a launch on Friday the 24th. The orbital ATK CRS-7 cargo launch to the International Space Station, and that is going to be at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. So, 8.5 hours countdown until that launch. So, check out the NASA website and NASA TV if you want to see that launch.
Hey, Marty, I had a flying story to close out the night.
All right, go for it.
Flying saucer story.
All right.
It's from the Bad Astronomer, so you know that something's up if he's talking about flying saucer. It's a joke. It's Cassini images of Pan, a very weirdly shaped little moon of Saturn. So that's fun.
That is a pretty cool little moon.
Yeah.
It looks like a flying saucer. It really does. People call it ravioli and other kinds of things like that. But very unusual moon. I'd say from a collision, but just, you got to look at it. It's just really unique, and it's really hard to figure out how this actually occurred like that. So, really, really kind of strange. Uh-oh, what?
Don't make people think it's aliens.
That's right. Alien spaceship. We'll start that rumor. Well, it's about time for us to get out of here. Only about 20 more seconds for us, so I want to thank everybody that's been in our chat room tonight. Really appreciate you you being here, and we always consider you part of our crew. Don't forget, 2 Astronomy Ireland and 2 Planetary Radios and Comet Watch tonight, right up after Space Pirate Radio. All right, everybody, time for us to head out of here. Appreciate you listening in. Catch us on the repeat. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website, It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.